So, it seems as if, as we were discussing this morning, creativity, what we call creativity, might be more fundamental than we thought. In other words, we think of it as a special thing, a special category, a rare thing that happens, you know, when we're creative, or we'd like to be more creative and so on. But in light of what we learned from Suzuki Roshi and our own reflections and writing about being nobody, it may be that creativity is actually something really fundamental. It's living. In other words, it's just really living and being present and being in touch with what we really are, which is to say, the part of ourselves that involves letting go and renunciation and being nobody. Being in touch with that part of ourselves and really not forgetting about it might be what creativity is all about, so that it's not a special category, it's just really living. And then, expressing ourselves out of that feeling, as we learned, can be complicated and troublesome. The more that we have thoughts and feelings and judgments about ourselves, the more difficult it is to make that kind of expression. So I actually don't like to think about, I don't usually use the word creativity that much or think about creativity, because it tends to privilege it too much for me. It tends to make the rest of life that's not creative, you know, seem insignificant. When I think that what we want to do with our lives is have all of our lives be significant, all the moments of our lives. And it seems to me that a long time ago, there were no special categories called creativity or art or religion. That this is a kind of modern invention. There was no religion, there was no art. People just were living, and they were doing the things that they did in their communities. And when it was time for worship or a festival, some people made pictures, played music, wrote liturgies. Other people prepared food, created physical space, maintained physical space, sewed costumes, wore costumes, danced. And it was all the same thing. You know, it wasn't like the creative ones over here and the other ones over there. And there was no religion. There's just, this is how we live. This is just our lives. And there wasn't a big space between the space where religion took place and your own house, because there was an altar in your house for the god, you know, that you worshipped in the ceremony. And it seems to be a feature of our time, as time marches on, that there's more and more, everything gets pigeonholed in a category. So now there's religion on Sunday in the church, you know, not in the rest of the week, but in the church on Sunday. And there's creativity that the artists do. And then the rest of us are not creative, because they're creative and they're professional creative people, and we're not. We wish we could be more creative, but because we have artists, we're all less creative, you know, than we were before. So that's why I really don't think in terms of creativity. And you know, as you may know, I have long time been engaged in writing, and especially poetry. Most of the writing that I've done in my lifetime is poetry, which most people think of as creative writing. I even, oddly, you know, got an MFA degree in creative writing, you know. But I don't think of my work in poetry as being any particularly different from anything else that I do. You know, it's just a function of my living. And I don't want to feel like I'm wasting my living unless I'm writing poems. Right? I want to be always living that creativity, to the point where there is no creativity, there's just living. So anyway, that's the I don't know what you think, but that's what I got out of this morning's conversation and my reading of Suzuki Roshi and my thoughts about Suzuki Roshi. And to me, this is, to me, such an important thing about our spiritual practice is that it is the fountainhead of creativity. Because it's a way of us returning to ourselves, returning to the somebody and the nobody that we all are of necessity. And it's when we return to the somebody and the nobody, and we're willing to engage the nobody as well as the somebody, that we really have a sense of being alive. And to me, that is creativity. Having said all that, though, we also have to admit that we do have a category in our contemporary life called the arts, and that's where the creativity belongs, right? So now, this afternoon, I wanted to talk about that. The arts, given what we did this morning, and given that we don't want to get carried away about how important the arts are and how artists are special people. And, you know, like, in fact, when I came of age as a poet, it was one of the very conscious decisions that the group of writers that I was associated with, writing poetry in the 70s and trying to figure out, you know, what was our generation's way of writing poetry. One of the things that we thought about was the idea of the poet as being an especially sensitive person who has, you know, feelings and perceptions that ordinary people don't have, and then expresses those feelings and perceptions in exquisite ways that other people would suddenly read and say, aha, what a wonderful sensitive person. I sort of feel that way too, but I need him or her to show me the way to such feelings. We kind of decided that we didn't believe in that. That didn't seem right. That it sort of did violence to the creativity and the soulfulness of every person. And so that one of the insights that we had as young writers was, well, it's not about how sensitive and brilliant we are, it's about the power of language itself. That everybody who uses the language is using the creative power in the language. And after all, if we're writing in the language, we're just using the same words that everybody else is using. Where's the creativity in that? How are we special? Just using the same words. So that was a different attitude toward writing, and not privileging writing or privileging ourselves as poets. And that gave it a whole different outlook. Anyway, what I would like to do in the next few minutes is, here's my plan, if it's not too self-indulgent or going too far. I thought I would read. I have an essay that I wrote some time ago about meditation practice and the arts, and I wanted to read you a few pages of that essay as a way of framing a conversation about the arts. And then, what I would like to do, if it's okay with you, is stroll down memory lane a little bit and read to you from some of my own work over the years, because the reason I'm thinking about this is because lately one of the university presses is proposing to publish a volume of my selected poems, which means looking over a whole career. I've published a lot of books. You know, my first book came out in 1980, and there's been a number of them steadily since 1980. But I never go back and really read them, you know. So, but now I have to go and read and select work from all the different books. So this is, I've been traveling around this week with my manuscript of my selected poems, and I thought I would read some of them for you. And the reason for doing that, and what I wanted to lead up to, is how did I make these poems? And what can be learned from this? What do I learn from this retrospective look at my career as a poet? And then this leads to a devious exercise that I've worked out for us to do, which I hope says something about how you make art. Anyway, this is the complicated plan. Okay? Is that all right? Okay, so this is, I don't know if you, there's a book of mine called Success. It's a book of poems that came out some years ago. And actually a series of poems, a series of double sonnets, 24-line poems. But at the end of the book, there's an essay called, Do You Want to Make Something Out of It? Zen Meditation and the Artistic Impulse. And so I want to read you a couple pages from that essay. Actually, there's not much written, you know, in about this topic. So this essay is sort of one of the few things you can find about a specific topic by someone who's active, you know, in the arts, about practice in the arts. The reason we need art so desperately is that the world and we ourselves persist in being made. There is something exhausting and troublesome in the madeness of the world and the madeness of ourselves. What is made always has the quality of limitation or unsatisfactoriness. Madeness captures us into a vicious cycle of desiring more madeness or better madeness. And the madeness we get only makes us want to make improvements or additions. This makes sense, doesn't it? We feel this way. Art making is an anti-making. It's an anti-making because it is a making of what is useless. This is what makes art art, that it is useless, that it doesn't do anything, that it is something inherently unmade, and this is the source of its liveliness. Any piece of art stares us in the face with the fact of its being what it is uselessly. It is a record of a person's commitment to the confrontation with the made, a confrontation one is bound to come away from second best. And yet one does it and reaches a peak of exaltation in the doing of it, and the artwork facing the viewer or hearer is a phenomenal testament to that useless confrontation, which by virtue of its supreme failure calls our life into question. If you really look at a piece of art or hear a piece of music or poetry or see a dance, you walk away wondering about your life. Does this make sense to you? If it's really there, you know, and sometimes, you know, you look at it and you say, so what? But if it really gets you, you walk away, you're kind of defamiliarized from your life. You sort of say, like, and who am I really, and what is going on? And my daily life that seemed so pressing a moment ago all of a sudden kind of disappeared. And I'm not sure anymore what's going on. And this is what these objects are supposed to do. This is why artists make such sacrifice in the doing of what they do, because this doing is the undoing, at least temporarily, of what has been done, this is the doing, at least temporarily, of what has done them in their lives, and what would do them in to the point of death or madness if it weren't undone in the process of making art. So there's a kind of sense in which, you know, art is a lifesaver. You know, certainly for artists and for people to whom art is important, art is literally a lifesaver. One of the qualities of artwork that has always impressed me is its unstable nature. The artwork is its physical presence, its words or notes or paint, and yet it isn't that. It isn't that. If you are hit in the face by a plank, you will definitely be hit by it and will feel the effects of it no matter whether you believe in planks or not, no matter whether you are in the mood for the sensation of pain or not. But if you make an effort to experience an artwork, you may or may not experience anything at all. It may strike you as a meaningless hunk of this or that, hardly worth a second look. Or it may strike you as profoundly moving one day and completely beside the point the next day. And I notice this about my own poems. I sometimes, when I look at poems of mine, there are times when I say, this is an incredibly great poem. Look at this. I can't believe that I wrote that, or somebody wrote it. The next day, this is the stupidest thing I ever saw. And you probably, you know, if you write yourself, you know what I'm talking about. And it's not because, you know, you're unstable I think it's because the work of art is unstable. That's the nature of it. Of all the people that will come into contact with that work of art, skip the sentence. Imagine an artwork, a great, like a great masterpiece, sent from one art gallery, from an art gallery to a museum. It's going to be in a big show, right? So it's being shipped from the art gallery to the museum. Of all the people that will come into contact with this work, the movers, the curators, technicians who hang the work, the security guards, and perhaps the thousands of people who will file by to see it, of all these, only a very few, will actually experience it as an artwork. And even those few might come back to the gallery the next day and not at all be able to fathom why the day before the work moved them so. And even if they could say why it moved them and explain it, that would only be a memory. And I sometimes go to museums and I look at the security guards in the museum. And I often talk to them and I say, what do you think of these paintings that you're standing here day after day seeing? And they often have interesting things to say. But it strikes me as so ironic and strange that, there'll be a security guard who's standing in a room at the Met in New York City, in a room that contains, I don't know, $300 million worth of art. The people who own those works of art don't see them really particularly. They might go into the Met and look at them and then they're gone. The security guards basically own these paintings. They own this $300 million worth of art. But the question is there any art in the room to them? And the answer is yes and no. Mostly no. Mostly they're standing there. They don't know that. They don't have the feeling that they're in the presence of this fantastic art, right? They're bored and they want to go home. I mean, it's strange, Don't you think? It's a strange phenomenon. The actual experience of this masterpiece painting will have occupied only a few seconds or perhaps minutes in the hours and hours of human contact with that work. Right? In other words, real experience of art is extremely rare, and it is fleeting and unstable. The poet Paul Valéry, the French poet, said of poetry that, and this is a quotation here, poetry is completely irregular, inconstant, involuntary, and fragile, and that we lose it as we find it by accident. Then later somebody puts it in a book, and then you go to school and they say, this is a great poem, and you say, yeah, right, that's right. Thank you for telling me. But actually, what's the actual experience there, and how often does it happen? So here's this very ironic thing, that this thing, which seems to be so life-giving and so crucially important because of the nature of our lives, is very unstable and fleeting and happens a lot more rarely than we ever imagine it does. Because, we've all been trained in the commodity value of the art, but not the actual, what it actually is doing. So it is a fantastic thing that people place such enormous value on something like this. Something so evanescent that we are really hard-pressed to say whether it actually exists or not. I suppose to some extent we value art out of long habit, or perhaps because it has become a good business. I have a son who's a visual artist and very highly trained, in New York, and he's a New York artist. And he's so, in New York art scene, is so profoundly aware of the business value of art that there's no way to make art without being 100% involved in that endeavor, to the point where you can hardly tell where the art part gets into it, And this is the only way. This is what you learn if you're an artist. In art's aspect of non-art, as a commodity or a cultural artifact that we can say, oh yes, I you and I can do business together, we've both read Wallace Stevens. So we know that we're both in the same general social class and level of education. Let's make a deal. So this, I mean, this is, we're laughing, but actually, it's pretty much, to a great extent, the cultural, what culture becomes, right? So that's what I mean by art's aspect of non-art. It becomes just as much a commodity as anything else people will pay good money for, probably even more so, because some sorts of art are even more subject to sudden economic inflation than an internet or gene splicing stock. And I'm always talking to my son about, you know, in the current economic situation, why don't people buy your art? They have a better chance of making a big killing on it than they do with a stock now. You know, stocks are probably going to go down, but you never know. If you pick the right young artist, you could make a lot of money. Yet at bottom, there remains the mystery of the uselessness of art, of the shifting and unmade quality of it, and of the tremendous need that we have for the unmade and the undone, no matter how unstable or accidental our experience of it may be. The experience of it, the actual experience of it, is precious and life-changing always. So, now the next question is, so how do you make these? How do you create something that at least has the potential of causing a viewer or reader to have this essential experience? So now, how do you make the unmade? Right? What does it take? How does that work? So that, in that spirit, I want to read some of my own poems and talk about how I made them. So, my last book, my last book of poems was called I Was Blown Back. And I felt like I was working on this book for about, I don't know, 5 to 10 years of making work in a certain vein. Anyway, when I finished it, I thought, this is what I've been trying to do, actually, from the beginning. And now that I finish this, I think I might be finished as a poet. That might be the end, which was a sad idea to contemplate, but I felt that way. So I didn't write for a little while, and then I thought, well, how would I start writing again? And so I thought, my thought was, suppose I get someone else to write the poems. If I'm finished as a poet, suppose I get someone else to write the poems. Seems a reasonable idea, right? So I began to consider, like, various characters that I could get to write the poems for me. Since I had nothing left to say, so I actually did that. I actually started writing poems in the voice of other people. So the book that I, my latest book that is not published yet, and I hope will be published this next year, is called Questions, Places, Voices, Seasons. And one section of it is, the section that's called Voices, is all poems written by other people, fake people. So there's a I created a fake rabbi who was born in Lithuania in 1820 and wrote prayers. This rabbi wrote prayers. He was a very simple guy. So I'll read you some of his poems. And so the idea here is that I put myself under a constraint. I was going to put myself in the mind of this person and sidestep all my own concerns and find out if things that I needed to express could be expressed by this constraint of creating another character. So, this is called Prayer for Peace. Oh God, I am wondering why people come to the point of feeling justified in their bitterness, so that the killing of one another and of thousands, even possibly millions of innocent victims, makes sense to them, and it seems necessary. Some people say that if you, God, were actually in charge as much as Torah says you are, that this would never happen. That there would be peace in the land, the lion lying down with the lamb, etc., as it is written. But we have never seen such things. Only have we seen the slaughter of our people, God forbid, again and again. Which must mean either you are not in charge, or are yourself the author of these atrocities, or that we don't understand you. Yes, I am sure that is it, that we don't understand. And so my prayer for peace must be, help us, God, to understand your ways, just enough so that we stop ruining ourselves, so that our anguished weeping at war and human strife will cease at last, so that we, not you, will put violence aside in a world of days and nights. Prayer for laborers. May all who labor with their hands, those who clean and cook, make beds and remove garbage, those who fashion things of this world as you have fashioned this world of words of your mouth, those who make small things crafted by hand, or very large things in the city's factories, but especially the smaller things of the earth made in small workshops near here, things like shirts or spoons or shoes, carts, pins and paper, buckets, rope. May all who make these things receive from you special blessings and extra protections, because they are noble and deserve the best of your care. And there's a whole series of these prayers. And this is not how I write. In other words, that doesn't sound like the poems that I usually write at all. And it was very liberating to create that constraint and then find other things to say in a voice that was not my own. One thinks of poetry, particularly any art, you think, I'm going to express myself in my voice. But suppose you are not expressing yourself in your voice. Maybe you become liberated from yourself. And maybe you find things that can be said that can't be said by you. So here's another few poems from the same section, Voices. These poems are called Versions of Saigyo. And Saigyo was a great... He's actually the seminal Buddhist poet of Japan. Very early, I think, in the 12th century. And all the haiku poets and all that source from Saigyo. And he was an intensely... He was a hermit, you know, and wandered the mountains by himself. And wrote many beautiful poems. And so I decided that what I would do is I would rewrite Saigyo's poems. So I wouldn't have to think about things to say. I already knew what was to say because Saigyo already said it. So all I had to do was... So I don't read Japanese, but I could read translations and I could think about them and I could then rewrite the poems. So that way I could, again, you know, this was the constraint here was... Okay, the only thing that can be said now is what's said in the poem. And I was working with these pre-existing poems. But of course they sound quite different from Saigyo's versions. These are my versions of Saigyo. How good it is for the body to cry until it becomes a lake into which the heart, a dark lump, pulls the moon down. I dream my mother's face as face of someone else, picture in a foreign language newspaper. Unbidden, I have given up the world, it's cheap, but I have not known it. Wear worldly clothes, a fool pretending to transcend time, which pierces me. Long for guests who never arrived in ordinary presence to my mountain hut. My disappointment equals glee in taste of happy loneliness that brought me this. When what's expected fails, or mind can't seize on what's to be, expected grief rains down, disorganized as cherry petals in this wind. And there's a whole bunch of those versions of Sagyo. And then, and again, that doesn't sound like the rabbi, does it? Because I was constrained by the form and the tone of Sagyo's poems. And some of the things that I wrote, the point here is that I was able to, by the creation of these constraints, I was able to produce things, to say things, and come upon things that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And this is one of my, this has always been my main interest. In other words, I have no interest at all in writing what I know about. Because why would I do that? I already know about it, you know? What I have an interest in is discovering what I don't know through the process of writing. And it's by creating different ways of writing. So I'm always looking to see, you know, what can be done here? What is writing anyway? What is language anyway? After all, we are language. You know, we have written ourselves into being, or spoken ourselves into being. The persons that we take ourselves to be are the persons that we've talked ourselves into. I mean, literally, right? That's the truth. And if you have, like, you know, bad speech, you know, wrong speech, you're a mess, right? So that's why the question of, you know, how do we speak and how do we write and what is language making us to be and how does this thing work? You know, the investigation of the obvious has always been my project as a poet. Now this is another one that I don't know if you know about the poet Robert Creeley. But Robert Creeley is one of my favorite poets. He's a really great poet. And, when you're a poet, you don't read poetry. You, like, eat it. And you swallow it and you digest it, you know. And so, not every poet, but the poets that matter to you. And this is what happened with me and Robert Creeley's poem. And I was lucky enough to meet him a few times. I didn't know him well, but I did have a chance to meet him. And so he died a few years ago. And when he died, among the community of poets, there were some poems of his that circulated, his last poems, circulated online, you know, after his death. So I was very moved by his life and his work and his poems, and so I decided to rewrite Robert Creeley's last poems. So these are After a Poem of Robert Creeley Circulated Online After His Death is the title of this poem. It's got two parts. One, when I think of my life, whatever life it is or has been, of how time passes or seems to pass, when I recall days, weeks, specifics, the river running by below me as I walked across one of several bridges, or the daily waking up in rooms or under sky, come back to gravity, identity, the physical world, sleeping, speaking a plain language, thinking, imagining a future that would never come, that was always and only now, here, as this here, this now of remembering, writing, memory's fatal touch, how strange it all is and always was, how hard I strained to grasp even a grain of it, a straw of it, to somehow reproduce or produce to match the sweep of it, but never could. Only ever unsatisfied in all productions that always fell, dissolved, but only in the process of their clumsy making some fleeting sense of recognition, as if something for a moment known or seen. And was I thought, the same person, or another, a separate one, or one of many nearly identical ones, never wanting to stand out or apart, to be anyone, yet always straining upward or outward, forward, toward the light, I suppose, as dumb plant, the so-called future, imagined, which is the past, so holding myself, I couldn't help it apart. For that, at the end of it all, and at the end of all this, I think it will come clear as dust motes or fog particles burst bright upon the retina of the or the brain. Pain, so living flares not as organized story, but in chunks, moments, flashes of color. How lucky it was to be alive. Two. And the funny thing is that if you know Robert Creeley's poetry, he wrote always in very small lines. Very laconic, short poetry. But these last poems, these are kind of imitations of these last poems in very long lines, strangely for Robert Creeley. Two, thinking of love, of loving you, simply that. But no, the word has too much been drained, its pungency, color, paled. So let's say I appreciate that it has been for so long possible to care so much, so warmly, and miracle of all, your intense, touching care for me, its constancy, that like food to the hungry, and not only basic sustenance, but dishes proffered with delicacy and abundance, has been given through all these days, these advancing years. Who could have expected it? It must be that an animal passion, once yielded to, guides our hands, our feet, in walking side by side, hand in hand, at a pace through all the nights spent, spooned together in the various beds, the many places on earth, spots of warmth there, because we were there together, there, blindly, dumbly, and perfectly, because dumbly, blindly, cleaved, like the sky, to each other. Persons, male and female of them, and the nights spent apart, each alone in darkness, thinking of or not thinking of, but being half of what we otherwise were, one of us, us out of which others came, as if it were a destiny to be so, as if it mattered or had specific meaning that echoed through the worlds we made, that made us in the households, meals, the silent landscapes, sound of temple bells, the tears, the hurt, so much laughter, so much shared and remembered through the flowing times and time, the history of the billions of all of them, small but always there in the life we've lived, loved, yes, somehow loved. The word now comes back to itself through what we've weathered and made real, or seemed to make, guided to it, in dark ways we never imagined when we began. So that poem is really about love, I think, and about Robert Creeley, and he wrote about love a lot, and you know, it's about my own life too. But I could have never written such a thing without that constraint and without Robert Creeley's voice. Let's see. Oh. A few more minutes and then we'll take a break. Everybody okay? Yeah? The poems that I mentioned before, from Success, the book Success. I gave myself the assignment, because I thought it would be interesting, of writing a double sonnet, 24 lines, out of 28 lines, a day, every day, for 365 days. This is the type of thing I think about. So I did that. And I did it with the kind of wonderful sense that who in the world is going to publish a book of 365 double sonnets? This will never happen. So this is a pure artwork. It will never be published or seen by anybody. And this gave me a tremendous delight, the idea that nobody would ever see it. Or, you know, unless I showed it to them personally. But then somebody said, well, did you ever think of making a selection? you wouldn't have to publish all 365 of them. You can make a selection. I said, you know, I never thought of that. What a brilliant idea. So that's what happened. This is a selection of a longer work. Maybe someday the whole thing will be published, but this is, I don't know how many of them, 125 of them or something like that. But what gave me this idea, and why is it called success? It's because this was written when my father was at the end of his life. He was really sick, and he would come to visit us quite often. And he would bring a little gift, you know, when he comes. And one time he came and brought a gift of a one of these like diaries that business people have, that where they write their appointments in it. And on the front of it, it was a bright red, like hardbound book with 365 pages, 28 lines on each page. That's where I got the idea of 28 lines. And it was on the front, it said Success, because that was the name of the diary company, Success Notebook and Diary Company. So I filled it up with 28 lines a day for the 365 days of the year. So, again, the point is, I was given, literally given, a set of constraints. I was given a form to work with. Okay, so I'll just read you a few of these. This is from the end. And the poems are always titled with the date on which they were written. So this is Saturday, 29 December. Year's end's the best time when winter wanders in on us, stays for a while, forever, eternal on the page, because sown into time in mind's immortal words, piled up tall, just as we reckon them, powerful to beat us at our own game. I think what I look for, I already uncovered in the bitter cold with moon and several very bright stars. The trees seem frozen, yet do not contradict what people say on the radio. The children, because of their concern to move on into dreams, fall onto things that hardly themselves move, or move so slowly they go nowhere measurably, and nowhere is measurable. I want to accept what's mine as I find it, not to look for it in anything extra someone is wearing in an advertisement, and so become confused more than I asked for in the beginning. So you see, when I knew there were 28 lines, I knew where I was going, right? To the 28th line. And I was free then. The constraint freed me to just get there any way I could. Sunday, 30 December. What I intended, what I dreamed of, is not what occurred. Yet what occurred is not different from my dream. Only it does not possess the quality of dreams in the naming of it in the mind. Horses ran wild in a howling wind. Some physical pain harbors the body and makes it last when there's no pain. Then that's joy and ease, to be able to move about in the air like a leaf, hardy, floating toward the beginning of fall, at last in my darkness. A flavor I couldn't speak of pours through me like fruit. People think I have lots of hats, but I really don't have that many hats. And it's not a question of hats. What I hold to's not what I originally picked up and then put down. So that really means something. But what? this is the thing. Monday, 31st December, the last poem. New Year's Eve, bonfire smokes, anything hard and easy to end, a year, a book, a life. Time ends in its midst, in front of total strangers, dropping the conclusions easily, like so many raindrops or pebbles. The edge of the book's the middle of the tongue, not so much in any meaning as in the physical action of flesh and the effort and intention, the feeling conveyed as sure as breath. No ideas but in words, poems built up tall, fall down again into heaps of rubble at the end of any life or civilization. What I have to offer is the presence of these things I can hear and see. Raise them up by virtue of my singing to them, having been moved by them, and in this way give birth to everything that never ends. So, let's take a break, and then after the break I want to kind of draw some conclusions from what I've learned from reading these poems and thinking about how I made them, and then that will lead us to an exercise that I hope will not only tell us something about poetry and art making, but also about living creatively. So can we take 15 minutes, and that means come back at about 20 minutes to 4. Thank you.